This is Dr. Scott McLeod, Director of the UCEA Center for the Advanced Study of Technology Leadership and Education, also known as CASEL. This is a podcast of my presentation to the Minneapolis Public Schools Technology Planning Steering Committee as they worked to set their new district technology plan for the years 2008 to 2011. This podcast begins right after I was introduced by Colleen Kozlowski, the Executive Director of Technology for the school district.
I run the only university center in the country that's dedicated to the technology needs of school administrators as opposed to teachers or students. And Colleen helped us get that entire initiative off the ground and helped us ground our curriculum, et cetera. And that has been a very, very good program. There are people in this room that have been taking part of that. And it's been a lot of fun. My task this morning is to get you guys thinking. So we're going to start with a short video. So sit back, grab your muffins and your coffee. Here we go. I really wish I could take credit for that. That was created by a staff development specialist at a high school in Colorado for his school. So we're going to spend a little bit of time, actually I'm going to spend a little bit of time, talking about future-oriented schools. In other words, how do we prepare students for the new millennium rather than the industrial age? You may want to write this URL down. So if you go to this web address, like tomorrow, not today, but then you'll be able to access both this presentation and the video that I just showed you, the Did You Know presentation, in case you want to share either of these with other people. And I'm also audio recording myself so you can hear me give this presentation again if you really get bored over the weekend. Totally. So we'll do the whole spiel. So anyway, scottmcleod.net/MPS, and I'll give that to you again later if you need it. And like I said, Colleen will get it to you too. As Bob Dylan said, the times, they are a-changing. And they're changing in multiple ways. I think we have seen some major societal trends happening that are going to cause the next few decades to be quite unique, both in American society and elsewhere. So I'm going to focus on four main themes: increased diversity, increased technology, the aging of our population, and this issue of globalization that's starting to pop up in people's minds. Back when I was born in 1968, 80% of this public school enrollment was white. You can see that today we're less than 60% white, our nation's public schools. Our African American population has increased slightly. Our Hispanic population has almost quadrupled, as has our Asian population. Our schools look a lot different than they used to. And in fact, we have many states, Minnesota's not one of them, but we have many states in which the minority is now the majority. As noted, on the technological front, our technology is changing quickly and rapidly, and I love this quote. It's like, imagine you took the entire Industrial Revolution and crammed it into a decade and a half. And that's what we've lived through so far, and the pace is getting even faster than it was over the past couple decades. And as Kramer notes, it's going to be quite a ride. Many folks are thinking about this issue of globalization. Technology is actually fueling the global economy and the interconnections. We're seeing economic interdependencies between countries. We're seeing cultural interconnections and interdependencies between countries. We are no longer isolated by the geography that within which we live, but we literally have access to the global cultures that are out there and the world's cultures in all the various places, in addition to the economic independence that's occurring. So Thomas Friedman has written about this quite extensively in The World is Flat. Richard Florida, who's a noted demographer who I will mention more about in just a minute, has also talked about this in The Flight of the Creative Class, two highly recommended books for those of you who have not read one or both of those. The graying of America, our population is growing older, not only in the United States, but in most Western or industrialized nations. You can see that in 1900, the proportion of our population that was 65 or older was only 4%. As of 2000, that was 12%, and it's estimated by 2050 that it will be up over 20%. And of course, as our older citizens become a more significant percentage of our population, you have to recognize that they have different interests and thoughts about how the world works than we do. And to be honest, many of these folks, they don't really understand technology that well. You know, I think about, you know, my parents and grandparents, and they're not fluid technology users. They don't really understand what some of this stuff is all about. And yet many of the people who are you know, have some experience, not, you know, young stupid guys like me, are the ones in charge. You know, they're in charge of our various organizations and policy-making entities and political organizations, et cetera. And so how do we help folks who didn't grow up with technology, who don't really understand technology or not fluid users of technology, understand the impact that it's having on our society? And how do we make adequate policy and decisions around societal activities and actions that are influenced and related to technology? So we have that issue. And recognize, of course, also that we have competing interests here. So as we get older, our life interests change. We're more interested in things like retirement and healthcare and other interests that are going to compete on the national and local policy agendas with education and K-12 technology and ramping our kids up for their future. So not only do we have different views of work and education and what life is like based on our own experiences as we get older, but we're also competing in some ways for the dollar, and we're competing for national attention. And so those are considerations that we have to navigate in the future. Richard Florida, I said that he's a noted demographer and urbanologist. He wrote this phenomenal book called The Rise of the Creative Class. And in a nutshell, what Florida talks about is that we've seen a dramatic shift in the population of our workforce over time. So if you're looking at our category here, you can see that over time, what Florida calls the creative class, the people who get to be creative in their jobs, the people who have some autonomy, some independence, some decision-making authority. They're not on the factory line doing what somebody else tells them. They're not the person sweeping the floors. They're not the person who's the nursing assistant. They're the people who are in charge, the people who have power, who have decision-making and authority, the people who have some independence and autonomy in their careers. That proportion of our workforce has grown from less than 10% in 1900 to almost 20% in 1975 to now almost 30% and growing. And it's the only sector of our working population that's actually growing. Our other two sectors, the service class and the manufacturing class, the working class, those sectors of our population are shrinking. And what we're seeing is that the technology is driving the growth of the creative class, in that it's fueling and enhancing and expanding their jobs and their careers and their work, whereas the folks who are in the service classes and the working classes, they're actually being replaced by the technology, because technology can now deduce many of the things that they were doing before. We're actually seeing some inroads of technology into some of the creative class. Like, for example, you no longer have to go to a high-priced attorney to get your will done. Right, you don't have to pay him $300 or $400 to get your will done when you can go down to the local Office Max and buy your $30 will maker CD and get a will made that's legal in all 50 states. And so that, you know, the will industry, for example, with attorneys, which has increasingly become commoditized anyway, is now being replaced by a CD that you drop in your computer. And so we're seeing those kind of things are occurring. Now, why do we care about the creative class? Why do we care that it's growing? Well, those are the people that make money. Those are the people that have sort of independence and autonomy. And so even though they're only about a third of our working population right now, A, they're the only one that's growing, and B, they account for over half of the total wage and income of everybody who's working in our society. So their economic impact is disproportionate to their population, and once again, they're the only sector that's growing. And the folks who are in service industries and working industries, they're either being replaced by the technology, or many of those jobs are going overseas to other places where they can afford to pay those people less money. Daniel Pink, author of A Whole New Mind, says to ask yourself three questions about your job. Number one, can somebody overseas do your job cheaper? Number two, can a computer do your job faster? And number three, in an age of abundance, where we literally have tremendous wealth and opportunity in many sectors of society, is what I'm offering in demand? And if your answer to one or two is yes, if your answer to number three is no, he says your job's in trouble. And so as we think about sort of what are the skills of the new economy, what are the skills that are needed in the creative class, they're very different skills and employment aspects than what we looked at before. So in the old days, to be a member of the service class or the working class, which was the predominant percentage of the working population, You basically did what you were told. Somebody else told you what to do. There wasn't a lot of sort of free thinking or independence or autonomy. But what we're seeing in the creative class is that the very jobs are premised upon the idea that you will have independence and autonomy, that you'll be forging relationships, that you will be collaborating with other people, that you'll be exercising creativity and innovation, and you'll be solving problems, and you will be detecting patterns and synthesizing those into new areas where you're adding value to existing things. And I think what we're seeing is we're moving from a manufacturing type of economy to an innovation kind of economy. And innovation has always driven the growth of our economic aspects of society, but we're seeing now is that a lot of that innovation is not tied down to material things. They're not things we're making necessarily. They're not the physical aspects. They're not, you know, we're not growing things or making things. Those things are occurring somewhere else where they can pay those people cheaper. And what we're seeing is we're working with aspects of the mind and the software and the technology and with people. And it's sort of that kind of work is the area that's growing. And that's the creative work that we should be striving to prepare our kids for, if for nothing else, because that's where the biggest economic security is. So the question becomes, are schools focusing on the right things? And as David Wehrlich so aptly notes, no generation in history has ever been so thoroughly prepared for the industrial age. Many others are also concerned that perhaps schools are focusing on the wrong aspects, and that we have not changed quickly enough. Obviously, the video, Did You Know?, recognizes that technology has been changing quite rapidly, and it's very hard for us to keep up with many of these things. The new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce, which is an outgrowth of the National Center on Education and the Economy, just came out with a big report called Tough Choices or Tough Times that basically put all this into sharp contrast and started noting that the skills that we're currently preparing our kids for in school are not the skills that are needed for the new economy. And then they made a series of recommendations, which some of them seem a little far out to me, but bottom line is they frame the issue quite nicely. Now we have to figure out what do we do about it. Now, the new commission is not the only one that's been talking about this stuff. So, for example, the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, which is a collaborative between educators and policymakers and corporations, has also noted that what we've traditionally covered in school, the core subjects, are only a small aspect of what people need to know in the new globally interconnected society, and that there's actually 21st century sort of content stuff that we need to talk about, and that we need to focus more on the learning and thinking skills that are required to be part of the creative class. And we need to figure out how to handle this issue of ICT literacy, particularly when that ICT stuff changes every couple years. And how do we handle things like information literacy and media literacy so that when you're looking at a resource, you can tell whether or not it's a valid resource that's worth paying attention to. ETS has done a very fascinating study. They've come out with a new ICT literacy assessment that's intended to assess high school students and college students' ICT literacy. And one of the things they found is that students are extremely skilled technologically. They can navigate the environments quite effectively. But when given five, they say, all right, they simulate the search, okay, simulate a search for some body of knowledge. And then, so this, they assess, for example, like what kind of choices, word choices, did the student use to search for that thing? And then when they get up a list of sources up on the screen, they have like a list of 10 things to pick from. Which ones do they pick and why? And they're finding that the technological skill is there, but the wisdom around what to choose and how to interpret it and how to selectively interpret what they're looking at is not there. And partly, it's our fault because we haven't trained them. We've left them on their own to figure it out. So those are the kinds of things that fit in here. And then, of course, the big question for all of this is that as the things that we need to know and be able to do become more multifaceted is how do we assess those things, right? What kind of assessments do we use? How do we assess whether or not a kid can be creative, whether or not a kid can be collaborative in groups, whether or not can communicate globally using technology? How do we assess those kinds of things? Just in case you're thinking that it's all national task forces and industry groups, recognize that Time Magazine had this phenomenal article that came out in December called How to Build the Student for the 21st Century. And of course, I should be ready here. But the opening of the article has this wonderful quote, which I'll read to you, where it says, "For the past 5 years, the national conversation on education has focused on reading scores, math tests, and closing the achievement gap between social classes. This is not a story about that conversation. This is a story about the big public conversation the nation is not having about education. The one that will ultimately determine not merely whether some fraction of our children get left behind, but also whether an entire generation of kids will fail to make the grade in the global economy because they can't think their way through abstract problems, work in teams, distinguish good information from bad, or speak a language other than English. If you haven't read that article, highly recommend it. We have a not-so-hidden revolution occurring in schools and in society. We often call this Web 2.0. What do we mean by Web 2.0? Well, Web 1.0 is where we had sort of these static web pages. People could make them themselves, but they realized very quickly that it was too tiresome and cumbersome and difficult. You had to learn HTML coding and put it up, and it was just sort of a pain. So we left it to the big entities that could afford to invest resources in content creation. And so pretty soon, a vast bulk of the web was dominated by these big media companies and larger corporations where they were using web pages to push out information to us. And they basically controlled the message for the most part. There wasn't a lot of interactivity. There was some, but not a lot. In the past few years, and literally within the last 5 years, we've seen a push towards what we're calling Web 2.0, where now we're starting to get internet-based tools and other digital tools into the hands of users in such a way that rather than becoming content consumers, they're actually becoming content producers. Right? So we're putting the power into the hand of the users, and what we're finding is that when we do that, is that we're seeing tremendous increases in collaboration, often voluntary. Think, for example, something like a Wikipedia, right? Where somebody had the idea to create the world's largest encyclopedia. People voluntarily donate their time to go in there and write articles and edit articles and make sure things are, you know, do fact-checking and whatever. And that thing is now enormous compared to what used to be the most comprehensive encyclopedia, which is the Encyclopedia Britannica. Unless you're concerned that those two resources may be unequal in terms of quality, we're finding that they have about the same rate of error, which is quite interesting. We see the open source software movement where people are voluntarily coming together to create things like Firefox, a new browser, because they want it to be better than the old one. And they're voluntarily donating their time, etc. We're seeing the hands of the users, the power in the hands of the users take place in the form of creative outlets. So you no longer, for example, need to be a publishing company to create a book. You no longer need to be a recording studio to create a record album. You no longer need to be a movie studio to create a video. The tools necessary to do those things are now so low cost that they're almost no cost, right? If you, for $500, you can make your own digital video, your own digital movie, and get it out there. The cost that used to be associated with sort of production have just come down tremendously, and we're fueling this huge surge in creativity, and people are rising up and saying, yes, if you give me the tools and the power to do that, I will. And we're seeing a lot less time, for example, passive. We're seeing folks spending a lot less time watching TV passively, for example, and instead voluntarily creating, you know, YouTube videos or whatever. The disintermediation piece is occurring here, where we no longer have these large corporate entities that stand in the way of us. We're now, the power is in the user. You no longer need a recording company to a record label to distribute your music. You can go straight to the consumer through a MySpace network or through some other kind of internet-based topic. You've got a cool digital video that you want people to watch that maybe will lead to a movie contract. You no longer have to go through the movie studios to do that. You can reach the consumer directly. And the tools are set up that they can find you also, which gives you incredible reach. So we now see that folks are reaching people that they never would have reached before, you know, through blogs and through video creation sites and music creation sites. I mean, I've been blogging since August. And I'm now interacting with people all over the world that I never would have met otherwise. And they're giving me feedback and evaluating some of the stuff that I'm putting up there and really forcing me to think critically about what I'm doing. And I never would have gotten those interactions. But the blogs make it so easy to get that kind of interaction and that feedback. And, you know, we see like Amazon rankings where you can throw a book out there and people will voluntarily go in and talk about their perceptions of the book. And this is all occurring. So the reach and the disintermediation of the middle entities, et cetera, is all occurring. So the power is in the hand of the users, and literally most of this stuff has popped up within the last 3 to 5 years, which is an awfully short time when you think about schools and change and that kind of stuff. So a quick tour of Web 2.0, we're talking about things like wikis, where people can voluntarily go in. I mean, they can collaboratively go in and create web pages together with just a click of the button. So you no longer have to know coding to make a web page. You just click on edit the page, you type, you do some formatting like your word processor, you hit save, there it is, it's up on the web. It's just that easy. blogs, you know, folks like me who are getting like 275 people a day, and the big guys who are getting like 20,000 people a day, 30,000 people a day, and then you multiply that every single day, you know, at 200 readers a day, four posts a week, 50 weeks a year, I've got 40,000 person interactions with my content, people who are voluntarily reading my blog because they like what I have to say. Could I get that just like hanging out locally around town? Absolutely not. No way. So podcasts, where we're talking about creating audio podcasts or video podcasts and making these broadcasts and these interviews and these conference presentations available to anybody who wants them. YouTube and other online video situations where you can go in and see sometimes good content, sometimes dumb content. But bottom line is that YouTube is now one of the most popular sites on the web. Flickr, where we have online photo sharing, where people voluntarily upload their photos to the system and then put tags on it. So that, for example, maybe say you're doing a presentation and you need images of the Empire State Building in New York City. So you type Empire State Building into Flickr, and up pops everybody's photos that they've taken of Empire State Building. And you might add 30,000 photos, and you can go through, and they've licensed them. They'll let you use them for free. So and sort of this collection, these tags, this folksonomy that they call it, where people are voluntary uploading this stuff, and we get the power of the voluntariness coming together, and through easy search tools and tagging, we can find stuff that we wouldn't together. And the power is in the groupness, rather than each person uploading individually. Similarly, Delicious, which is a social bookmarking site, you can imagine that, let's say that we were all interested in some kind of topic like, say, school technology leadership issues, and that as each of us was surfing the web, when we found a good resource, we bookmarked it into the same area, into our Delicious account. Well, then somebody new who's coming in and says, well, you know, I'm really interested in school technology leadership issues. They can look up school technology leadership, and up will pop all of our bookmarks that we all collaboratively made. I have access to not only the ones I'm able to find myself, but everybody else's bookmarks. And they even will say, well, look, this one has been bookmarked 29 times. This one has been bookmarked 4 times. This one's probably better, right? I'll start here. And that's, again, the power of the socialness of all this. Dig, which is a news service where as people read articles and other things on the web, they say, yeah, that's a good article, and they dig it. And you, for example, can say, what's the most popular article being read today? What's the, you know, the best article that people have dug the most? Google Maps and mashups, where Google Maps has opened up their programming interface so that other people can access it. So rather than being proprietary, this openness of the web where we're releasing things and saying, how can you take our basic system and improve it on your own, just like dinking around, you know, at home or on the weekend? And they're coming up with these mashups. So you can go, for example, and say, you can go to Google Maps, or you can go to the Starbucks Coffee Finder mashup, where you can type in your address and I'll show you where all the Starbucks around your house are. Or you're in a foreign city touring as a tourist, you can say, hey, where's the local coffee shop? And up will pop. They're creating these mashups that are interfacing with the basic system. MySpace, which is one of the most powerful communication vehicles known to man right now. We wonder, why is MySpace so popular? Why does it have 106 million users and growing? Because it does one thing very well. It allows people to communicate quite effectively and to stay in touch quite effectively. So the old days of teenagers sitting on the phone talking to their friends, you know, and you're like, oh, get off the phone. Well, I'm talking to my friend. Mom, leave me alone. Well, that's gone away because now that's only one-to-one. That's inefficient from a teenager's brain, right? Because now in MySpace, I can type 3 paragraphs and send it out, and 90 people know what I'm up to and what I'm thinking, not one, right? And simultaneously, I'm getting their feeds back and forth. And oh, by the way, we can also throw in music, and I can design my page in some horrible way, like decorating my room and all this stuff. And, you know, it just does. And the adults are starting to realize that MySpace is pretty powerful for that stuff, too. And companies are starting to realize that MySpace is powerful. It's a tremendously effective communication vehicle. So if one of the basic human needs is to communicate and to interact and connect, MySpace and other tools like it, Facebook, et cetera, do it quite well. Massively multiplayer online role-playing games where we have people coming from all over the world and they're playing games together online. So you're like a World of Warcraft, a Lineage, where they have literally, they have like a million or two users. And at any given time, you can go to a place like a Second Life and there'll be 100,000 people in this virtual world doing things together, interacting. And they're sometimes doing, you know, stuff that we would say is kind of stupid, like, okay, kill the dragon with your sword. But other times they're doing massively sort of creative, authentic tasks that are utilizing skills we would use in the real world. Like, for example, let's coordinate. I'm a guild master, and I need to coordinate 100 other people who are part of this guild as part of some economic activity that's taking place in the game. Or I'm a general in the army, and I'm coordinating 40,000 other people. We're getting ready to storm the castle, and I have to manage all this. And so what are we learning from those collaboration skills and those coordination skills and those time and project management skills? And they're finding out that these kind of skills that they're learning through gaming are translating quite well into real life. Video game mods, where again, like Google Mashups, we're opening up the interface to create entirely new things. So some of these video games, we'll take like a first-person shooter game where it looks like the purpose of the game is to go in and shoot people, and a corporation will modify it into like a flight attendant training seminar using the basic underlying code of the game. So this openness of the web and this idea of collaboration and creativity allows us to take these resources and use them in new ways. So Web 2.0, which again is very new, just the past 5 years or so, very interconnected, very reliant on collaboration. It's also very personalized and unique, right? We can set up our own individualized streams of information. We can sort of decide, you know, we can personalize our services and decide what information we get and what we don't. It's very autonomous. We're used to controlling on our end. Again, the power's in the hands of the user. It's not in the hands of the people on the web pushing stuff to us. It's in our power. We decide what we want to read, what we want to listen to, what we want to watch, what we want to see, etc. It's very freewheeling and open. And it's also very empowering. And we're seeing an explosion in terms of the people who are using these tools. So much so that right after this issue of Time Magazine was this issue of Time Magazine, where the person of the year was us, complete with a little Mylar screen where you could look and say, hey, that's me. Right? And it's all about how these Web 2.0 tools are empowering us to take charge of our lives, to take charge of our information, to take charge of our careers, etc., and all the different ways that the technology allows us to control our world, allows us to control the information age. So are schools teaching the right things? Well, if you start thinking about those words I described, interconnected, collaborative, personalized, autonomous, freewheeling, and empowering, do those words describe our typical classrooms? Clarence Fisher has this great quote, while we teach whatever we teach at school, the kids then go home to learn what they need to survive and prosper in an interconnected global economy. I'm going to take a quick side trip towards video games. Most of us, video games are almost invisible to many of us adults. We're not gamers. We're not actively involved in the world of video games other than to watch our kids play them. And many folks look at the content, the substance of some of these video games, and think they're just brain-rotting waste of time. And I would encourage you to at least start to think about video games as very high-powered learning engines, because there's several things that they do that are quite powerful cognitively, right? So when we say, for example, that kid can't sit still in class for 5 minutes, we then see that they can go home and they can be locked in for hours playing some video games. So something is happening up here in the brain. And what is it? Well, it's things like the kid can personalize his experience. It's totally geared towards that individual kid's experience and learning needs, right? So if you're a novice game player, your game is less difficult. If you're an expert game player, your game is harder. If you like to solve solutions in method A, it will start challenging you with method B until you get better at them. You like to solve problems in method B, it will start challenging you in method A until you get better at them. What else does it do? Well, it does a really nice job of simulating the environments quite well, so they seem very authentic and real. It allows you to explore identities if that's something you choose. And most importantly, the best thing about video games, the reason that they're so, quote, addictive, unquote, is that they operate under what Lou Vygotsky called the proximal zone of development, right? They're always just a little bit ahead of where you are. So they're not too easy. And they're not so hard that you turn off, and they're not so easy that you get bored, but they're always just a little outside your zone of competence, but not so far ahead that you don't think you can reach it. In fact, you say, well, if just a little more, I could get there. So you get there, and then what happens? The game shifts to the next level. No, but just a little more, I could get there. And it just keeps drawing you and moving you forward. And it's individualized and personalized to your own learning needs and your own learning pace. And that's the power of the games. And so Prensky talks about the fact that, you know, these kids are operating in environments at home where they're totally engaged, where they're in what Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi calls flow, where they're operating at optimal mental flow at all times or for long periods of time. And then they come to school, and the question is, are they that engaged? And if they're not, we wonder, well, why aren't they engaged with us? It's because we're not providing the kind of environments that they have access to in other places where they can lock in and experience that flow and operate at the optimal level of challenge and interest for them individually. Instead, they have to sit in a room full of 30 or 40 kids and passively acquire information rather than being active and empowered and involved and engaged. And when I'm talking about games, I'm not talking about games like this. This is like, for many educators, this is their conception of games. It's like Carmen Sandiego, Millie's Math House, Kids Phonics, this kind of stuff. We're talking about games that look like this. And this. And this. Okay, games that literally can simulate current or past worlds. And so I think we're going to see a big movement in the educational gaming environment. We're starting to see a lot of acceleration in the past year or so, where people are starting to say the gaming environments are now powerful enough that they can become authentic and useful tools for those of us in education. We can take a fantasy world simulation, like an Elder Scrolls Oblivion, for example, and we can modify that programming interface, and we can simulate, for example, what does it mean to be in ancient Egypt? So rather than having kids read three pages in a textbook and look at a couple pictures, and maybe we might have a video with some actors about ancient Egypt, instead they can literally be in ancient Egypt. And they could be the pharaoh. They could be the slave pushing the stone block. They could be the local merchant. They could be a farmer. You know, they have opportunities to try on different roles and see how society interacts in different ways and make authentic decisions about what it was like to live in ancient Egypt. Let's simulate colonial Williamsburg. Let's simulate ancient Zimbabwe. Let's simulate what it's like to really be a market trader in today's Wall Street floor. Let's simulate what it means to be a pilot. The military right now just basically assumes that anybody who's going to be a pilot has played all the flight simulation games already. We see doctors where they're actually spending 30 minutes playing video games before they go in and do laparoscopic surgery because it loosens up their fingers and their hands and gets them ready to go. So in the education world, we're starting to figure out, you know, we can use these environments to simulate, you know, the inside of an atom, you know, authentic physics. I was talking with Luke before we met around how some of these first-person shooters, they're grounded in very solid physics principles because they have to be play authentically. And so there's a lot of power in these things, and I think we're going to see some people tapping into them. So the challenge for us is that we're not natives in this world, many of us. We didn't grow up with this technology as an extension of our brain, as an extension of our arm, right? The kids today, most of them are natives, unless we have some access issues, and we still have kids who have access issues. But for many of them, either in their own homes or through friends' homes, they're basically immersed in this technology, and it's literally an extension of who they are, and they can't imagine even cutting themselves off from it. Now compare that to those of us who didn't grow up with it, who are more immigrants. Right? We're trying to immigrate into this world and figure out what does it mean and how do we survive. It's like being in a foreign country where we don't speak the language. And how do we do that? And then there's some folks, and maybe I would consider myself one of these people, that are sort of bridges. Like they didn't grow up with it, but they know more than sort of the immigrants, so we're kind of helping people bridge. A lot of your technology specialists, people like Todd, are bridges. We're trying to help people move and understand what that world looks like while it shifts. Then, of course, you have our refugees, the people who are like, oh, I'm going to pretend it doesn't exist. Or, you know, it's too overwhelming. I'm just, you know, I'm going to do as little as possible. And then there's sort of the undecided folks, as Wesley Fryer calls them. They don't know what they are. And, of course, we have educators in all these groups. We have some natives, and we have some bridges, and we have some immigrants, and we have some refugees. And the challenge is, how do we navigate all of that? And most important, how do we avoid irrelevance? How do we stay relevant in this quickly changing, globally interconnected time? There are over 14,000 school districts in our country. There are approximately 125,000 public and private schools in our country. Most of them are really struggling with this stuff. And so what we see is that we're seeing technological and social change occurring at a much faster rate than our institutions can keep up with, than our schools can keep up with. And so how do we handle that without becoming irrelevant? Because what's happening right now is that our schools change. Our schools aren't static, despite what the public thinks. We're always changing, but our pace of change is slower than that occurring around us in society. Right? Technology is having massive seismic impacts in society, but it's having right now still marginal impacts on how we do things in schools. Right? If you took away technology from the banking sector or from the manufacturing sector or from most sectors, of society, including agriculture, if you took technology away, the core work of most employees would stop immediately. They could not function anymore. But if you took away technology from K-12 and university educators, the core work of most employees, instruction, would go on as if it had never been there, right? It's still marginalized. It's seen as something that's extra or optional, as opposed to being something that's tightly integrated and essential and core to what we do. And of course, Jack Welch, the CEO of GE, has said that when the rate of change outside exceeds the rate of change inside, the end is near. Seth Godin, I love this quote. He says, "We cannot handle this much change. You're moving too fast." And he says, "What choice do you have? You know, you think I'm extreme, but the bottom line is it's reality. Whether you want it to or not, it's occurring. So the question is just, how do you keep up as best you can? And what do you do? And what kind of seismic shifts do we need to make in K-12 and post-secondary education like we've seen in the rest of society? We need to somehow change faster because our current model looks like this. We're here. We think we're going to make some incremental improvements. Oh, we'll get a third of our teachers trained this year. And then next year we'll train another third. And then next year we'll train another third, and so on, right? We really need to get here. And what's the problem is that what's in between where we need to be and where we are now with incremental improvements is a big frickin' wall, right? And Miguel Gulen, who's the instructional technologist for the San Antonio School District, says, nobody jumps a 20-foot chasm in 2 10-foot jumps. And yet that's exactly what we're trying to do here. So we're trying to make incremental improvements while around us society is making revolutionary changes. This is what schools can't do. We cannot afford to be refugees if we want to be relevant to our future society. If we want to somehow take charge of this rather than having mandates dictated to us, NCOB anyone? Then we need folks who are leaders rather than managers. We need folks who are anticipatory rather than reactionary. We need folks who are future-oriented rather than compliance-oriented. Liz Phair, noted indie rocker, has said, what does it mean when something changes how it's always been? We need to start having those conversations in K-12 education, and we need to start thinking further out, and we need to start thinking more about how do we make technology a core part of our enterprise, and more importantly, how do we shift our pedagogy to take advantage of the skills and tools that are required for the new economy, not the industrial age? Thank you very much.